Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a cynical and self-serving provocation that achieved its goal with two wannabe jihadis dead from a shootout with police at an event in Texas in which Islamophobes and bigots gathered for a competition to see who could present the most sacrilegious and insulting cartoon of the Prophet Muhammad in order to win a $10,000 prize offered by the organizer of the Hate Fest, Pamela Geller. Mark Potok, the director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project and author of the SPLC's Hate Watch blog, joins us to discuss the role of professional Islamophobes who have so far managed to get eight American states to institute anti-Sharia laws despite any evidence that anyone is seriously proposing such a ludicrous legal impossibility. Then we'll hear from Mike Gauss, president of the America Together Foundation and the Foundation for Pluralism in Dallas, Texas, near the scene of the shootout. He joins us to discuss this so-called expression of free speech in the form of a competition to draw the most insulting cartoon of the Prophet Muhammad in order to provoke Muslims, and the extent to which this is a case of one group of fanatics managing to bait another group of fanatics into threatening public safety. Then finally, we'll examine new evidence and lines of inquiry into the disappearance of 43 students in Mexico, an incident that infuriated and mobilized the Mexican public to demand justice and accountability. Ryan Devereaux, who covers national security and criminal justice for The Intercept, joins us to discuss his new article at The Intercept, Ghosts of Iguala, Mexico, How 43 Students Disappeared in the Night, and the possibility that justice in this case that has been long delayed is still denied. And joining us now is Mark Potok, who's the director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project and editor of its award-winning quarterly investigative journal, Intelligence Report. In addition to editing the magazine and the Hate Watch blog, Mark Potok acts as a key spokesman for the Southern Poverty Law Center, a well-known civil rights organization based in Alabama. He has testified before the United States Senate and the United Nations High Commission on Human Rights. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Potok.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
And Mark, this incident down in Garland, Texas on Sunday night where these two gunmen opened fire on a gathering that was a competition, actually, to offend Islam. And in other words, people were invited to draw caricatures of the Prophet Muhammad, and their prize was a $10,000 prize for, I guess, the most inflammatory cartoon. And then, of course, the two gunmen were shot. A guard was wounded in the ankle. And now the gunmen have been identified. But the whole point about this, as far as I can tell, is that this is complete provocation on the part of this Pamela Geller woman who organized the whole thing, who was a sort of a professional Islamophobe.
Yes, I think that's a real accurate recounting. You know, I think that Pam Geller is a provocateur. I mean, let me say that nothing she did, deserved killing her for, killing lots of people at this event. But this is what this woman does and has done for many years. You know, she is the person, our listeners may remember, who essentially ginned up a huge demonstration in New York City in 2010, against the Park 51 project. It was neither a mosque nor was it a ground zero, but Geller described that as a victory mosque. In other words, that the plans were to put up a mosque at ground zero, which would be a celebration of the murder of 3,000 Americans. You know, just one of 100 completely false things that Geller has claimed. You know, this is a woman who has done things like put up her own caricature of the Prophet Muhammad on her website with the face of a pig. She at one point had a video up on her website which suggested that Muslim men engaged regularly in bestiality with goats. And it goes on from there. I mean, she's got a real thing about President Obama, who she has described as a secret Muslim, as wanting jihad to win, as having a fake birth certificate, and even more wild than that, she says that Obama, or she's published a piece saying that Obama is the, quote, love child, unquote, of Malcolm X, that Obama was involved sexually with a, quote, crack whore, that Obama's mother posed for pornographic magazines, and on and on and on. So, yes, this woman is a provocateur. And that's what this entire event over the weekend in Garland, Texas, was about.
And her organization, the American Freedom Defense Initiative, that put this event on is also, it goes by another name, Stop Islamization of America. Now, that's just completely absurd, isn't it? I mean, where do they get these ideas, though, Mark, that somehow Sharia law is taking over the land? I mean, they passed laws in various state legislatures in Oklahoma and Kansas against Sharia law. It's a non-starter. It's not happening anywhere. The only imposition of religion in this country is coming from Christian fundamentalists.
Well, that's absolutely so. But this is, you know, Pam Geller and her organizations are a part of a small gang of Islamophobes in this country who do their very best to drum up these kinds of nightmarish propaganda fairy tales. So you're absolutely right. I think we're up to 8 states now that have passed these anti-Sharia laws. And this mainly came from a particular man named David Yerushalmi, who wrote the model law. And who himself later admitted, well, yes, of course, there was no possibility of Sharia law being imposed on American courts, but he was pushing this around the country in order to get a discussion started. Well, you know, I think that's fairly ridiculous. The reality is that, of course, what these anti-Sharia law statutes do is focus attention on Muslims, American Muslims, and paint them as seditious people who are trying to do in the rest of us. And as a realistic matter, Muslims in the United States are certainly much less radical than Muslims elsewhere. And, of course, even globally, only a very tiny percentage of Muslims is involved in organizations like the Islamic State or has any kind of sympathy for them. But that all these kinds of distinctions mean nothing to Pam Geller. To her, Islam, as she has said, is the most extreme and radical ideology on the face of the earth. You know, she's into this idea of a caliphate is secretly being imposed on the United States, Sharia law is being imposed. The facts mean very little to this woman.
So the keynote speaker at this organization, this competition to offend Muslims by drawing caricatures of the Prophet, and I imagine for a $10,000 prize, the more outrageous and sacrilegious your rendition of the Prophet is, the more likely you are to win this prize. But the keynote speaker is a guy called Geert Wilders, an anti-Islam leader from the Netherlands. He's the leader of the party called the Party for Freedom. What do you know about him? I mean, in other words, are these people on the list, if you will, of hate groups of like the Ku Klux Klan? And
well, certainly they are on our list of hate groups, and we're really the only ones that compile such a list. So, yes, American Freedom Defense Initiative and Geller's either other organization or just an alter ego for this one, Stop Islamization of America, we list both of them as anti-Muslim hate groups. Geert Wilders is quite infamous. You know, he has been banned from certain European countries, as has Pamela Geller. Geller is not allowed to enter the United Kingdom because she is seen with her outrageous propaganda to be a threat to public order. In this country, of course, under the Constitution, she's essentially untouchable making these kinds of statements. You know, but that is the kind of person she is. Wilders is actually an old friend of hers. She has spoken at his events and vice versa in the past. So, you know, Wilders is really known right across Europe as probably the most infamous parliamentarian on the continent in terms of going out and bashing Muslims. And again, I just want to make the point that this is not any kind of nuanced criticism about radical Islamists, who most certainly are a threat, who, after all, murdered 3,000 Americans on 9/11. This is just a blanket condemnation of the theology, you know, of the billions of people who practice Islam without any distinctions whatsoever. You know, I see her on television today running around saying, we're not opposed to Islam or to Muslims, just radical Islamists. And that's false. It's simply completely false. You know, I'm looking at a quote right here from her saying, I do not believe in the idea of moderate Islam, right? She doesn't think there is such a thing. So I think that's the bottom line here.
Well, what do we know about the two shooters have just been identified? One is Elton Simpson of Phoenix, Arizona. He apparently had been on the FBI's radar. He apparently had tried to go to Somalia. to join, al-Shabaab. And the other person's been identified as Nadir Sufi. It looks as though these two guys really did take Pamela Geller's bait, right? I mean, that's...
Well, I don't know exactly where they're coming from. I know nothing about the second suspect, who was just named a few hours ago. The first is, you know, he's a black American who converted to Islam, it seems, quite recently. And the indications are that he didn't know much about it, but nevertheless had been tweeting about what a terrific organization the Islamic State was and so on, and also tweeted immediately before the attack that something to the effect that he hoped the two of them would be accepted as real mujahideen after this attack. So that's what we know. I doubt whether, well, I just don't know. We have no idea if he may have been listening to Geller or not. Of course, there, you know, the African-American community, there's a substantial slice who are Muslims, but, of course, virtually none who are sympathizers of the Islamic State or ISIS or anything like that.
Well, apparently they'd been planning, the local police in Garland, Texas, had been working with Pamela Geller and the organizers of this competition to insult Islam.
Well, I mean, to be fair to Garland, you know, it was a public space.
Right.
And as a public space which is rented regularly to groups, they cannot engage as a government body in viewpoint discrimination. So when Geller came along and wanted to rent this place, they essentially had to do it. And let me say that a part of the provocation on her part was going to Garland. What she wanted to do, and in fact did do, was hold this contest in the very same room at the same community center in Garland, where in January a Muslim human rights organization, the Council on American Islamic Relations, held an anti-Islamophobia event. So, you know, she was kind of poking a stick in their eye. That was really the whole point of this. In any case, so Garland was forced to do this, and I think law enforcement did a very good job. You know, they actually had to do all this planning. They were smart enough to understand how controversial, doesn't cover it, I mean, how incredibly provocative Geller and her people were, and they took actions proactive that really did save the day. But, of course, at the end of the day, a lot of that money is coming right out of the pockets of the taxpayers in Garland, who really had nothing to do with Geller. There were virtually no local people at this event.
Well, as it happens, they did have a lot of SWAT and FBI,
right,
and bomb squad and ATF were all there, along with the Garland police. And as it happens, it was a local Garland police traffic officer who shot the two guys.
Yeah, it was a fairly spectacular piece of work on that officer's part. You know, he was facing two men with semi-automatic weapons running toward him from a car, and he had only his service revolver, which I assume was a 9mm pistol, and was able to take them down without anyone getting hurt beyond what sounds like a fairly minor wound to one security guard's leg.
So what are we hearing from Pamela Geller? I mean, how is she, I know it doesn't matter. You're dealing with somebody who's, you know, obviously an incredible self-promoter. I mean, she drove her husband into an early grave with toy boys and excessive plastic surgery, and then tried to take her own children's inheritance to spend it on herself. I mean, she makes the sort of housewives of New Jersey look like Mother Teresa, but obviously this is all about her and self-promotion, and it has little to do with any, you know, there is an ideology there, an ideology of hate, but I don't know why anybody takes it seriously to begin with, but unfortunately we have to cover what's just happened, and she is largely responsible. So what is she saying now?
Well, I think she's crowing. I think this is the best week of her life. You know, this is somehow proof that those, you know, mean and unpleasant Muslims will murder people who disagree with them. You know, I mean, look, it's akin to Terry Jones, that crazy reverend from Florida, burning a bunch of Korans, you know, which then provoke riots, and we see 10 or 15 people killed in North Africa. Right? You can't blame Jones or Geller as a criminal matter for these things. We couldn't put them in prison for their role. But my God, as a moral matter, you know, they are absolutely working to provoke this kind of thing. And, you know, I think the sad truth is it probably would have been better for Geller if people had died other than the attackers. So, you know, yes, I think that that's really what it's about. What she's been on TV today claiming is there are things like, you know, she describes the American Freedom Defense Initiative as a human rights organization, which I must say is one of the worst jokes I've heard in a while, and also tries to portray this entire event over the weekend in Garland as a great and passionate defense of free speech. And I think that is just bogus. I think it has very little to do with free speech and a whole lot to do with the ego of Pam Geller.
Well, it also sort of relates, I think, to Charlie Hebdo in the sense that just we've recently, the group Penn, the writers group, had, they're hosting a big awards dinner for the Charlie Hebdo survivors. And a number of very prominent and serious writers, members of Penn, boycotted the meeting because they thought that the Charlie Hebdo people, not that they brought it on themselves in any way to justify what happened to them, but they were nevertheless being, you know, sort of unnecessarily provocative. And
well, that's right. I mean, there's an interesting conversation to have around the comparison to Charlie Hebdo. I mean, what the Penn writers, I think, who are boycotting the event were saying was a reasonable thing, it seemed to me. What they were saying is, you know, what satire is really about or should be about is satirizing or caricaturing the rich and the powerful, the big institutions, the people who kind of rule the rest of us. And, of course, in criticizing Islam and Muslims in France, what Charlie Hebdo was doing, in fact, was criticizing a very poor and very vulnerable part of the population. However, I think there's still a huge difference between Charlie Hebdo and Pam Geller's organization. There have been some content analyses done of what Charlie Hebdo has published over the years, and only a very, very, very tiny percentage has targeted or satirized Muslims or Islam. The vast majority of what they do is more like satirizing the Catholic Church, which, of course, is very big in Paris, satirizing politicians and so on. That seems to me quite different, this kind of equal opportunity satirizing of everything and everybody around you, than an organization like Pam Geller's, which essentially exists in order to defame one particular very vulnerable minority of people.
So what can be done? I mean, obviously, you know, she would like to be made a martyr. If anybody went after her and tried to shut her down, you'd only give her more publicity. But is there any way that these kind of provocateurs who really are trying to cause social divisions and incite violence can be, if they can't be in any way dealt with by the law, can they at least be isolated and shamed?
Well, that's been our theory in dealing with many of these kinds of things, but I will say that Pam Geller does not strike me as a person who is shameable. In other words, she's shameless. You know, look, as a practical matter, no, there is no way that Geller's speech can be shut down. She is utterly protected by the First Amendment and the Constitution in general. So, you know, there are some very narrow exceptions in the law to freedom of speech protections, but they just wouldn't apply. I mean, the one thing that one could talk about is criminal incitement. But criminal incitement requires an inciting in a very intimate situation, and what the case law describes as an excited situation. So saying, you know, it is perfectly legal for a person to stand in front of a crowd of 1,000 people and saying, you know, we would do well to kill all the Muslims in this country because we would be so much happier then, or whatever it may be. That is kind of, that's a general idea, and that's more or less what Geller engages in, as opposed to direct and personal criminal incitement.
Yeah, but isn't there, in terms of the limits on the First Amendment, you can't cry fire in a crowded theater?
Well, I just don't think the analogy applies here. I think she can say these kinds of things You know, when she gets down to a very specific urging, a very specific person to do a very specific thing, which is illegal, then we're in the realm of criminal incitement.
I see.
Like I say, I mean, one, you could get dressed up in a full Nazi regalia and give a speech to, a theater full of people about killing the Jews, and it would be completely fine, at least in terms of criminal sanctions.
Well, Mark Potok, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
A real pleasure, as usual. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Mark. And again, I've been speaking with Mark Potok, who's the director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project and the editor of its award-winning quarterly investigative journal, Intelligence Report. In addition to editing the magazine and the Hate Watch blog, Mark Potok acts as a key spokesman for the Southern Poverty Law Center, a well-known civil rights organization based in Alabama. He has testified before the United States Senate and the United Nations High Commission on Human Rights. We're going to take a brief station break and be back looking into whether the Texas shootout is a case of one group of fanatics managing to bait another group of fanatics into threatening public safety.
Until that day, the dream of lasting peace, world citizenship, rule of international morality, will remain illusion to be pursued but never attained. Now everywhere
already gone. You can ram my whole life down in a little book when I'm already gone. I started shaking and my heart breaking and my belly crawls. But Jesus fever is falling.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Mike Gauss, who is president of the America Together Foundation and the Foundation for Pluralism, based in Dallas, Texas. He's a speaker, writer, educator, and activist for pluralism, interfaith, Islam, Israel, India, and human rights. And his work is listed at mikegauss.net. That's GHOUSE.net. And his daily blog is thegaussdiary.com. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mike Gauss.
Thank you so much, Ian. I appreciate that.
And the fact that this horrible incident took place quite near where you are in Dallas, Texas, in the suburb of Garland, Texas, it does seem that Pamela Geller went out of her way to provoke this incident. It was a competition, in effect, of who could demean, distort, and desecrate one of the world's great religions, Islam, and its prophet, Muhammad. $10,000 was offered to who could do the most provocative cartoon, which presumably would be the most insulting cartoon you could possibly come up with. So it's so obvious that this was an attempt to both insult Islam and to attract attention. And it's almost as if these two shooters that showed up were a gift to Pamela Geller. How do you see this whole thing playing out?
Well, first of all, I condemn the shooting at Garland, the art exhibit. Secondly, I am a strong defender of freedom of speech. It is embedded in Islam. In fact, Adam was given the choice at the very beginning to eat the fruit and the consequences for that, and he did. And God did not slap him around and tell, hey, Adam, don't make that mistake. But God let him choose the option that was offered to him. So the freedom of speech begins right at the very inception of humanity. And that is a right that nobody can take it away from us. So I have defended Pamela Geller when she was kicked out of England for preventing her from making a speech. I defended her right. And then, on the other hand, I also defended the right of Pastor Terry Jones in Florida, and I was there to the event. And I also defended Ghannouchi, the Moroccan scholar, from speaking at Yale, which Pamela Geller opposed for free speech. So that is my background with the relationship with Pamela. and I have known her for the last 10 years. And I talked to her frequently about this, but she does not have a goal she to achieve other than provoke people, and the controversy feeds her ego, and that other than that, I don't see any other purpose serving this. Yes, we should defend freedom of speech, but this is not the way to defend. And what was the point in making the cartoons of the prophet? If she wanted to do it, she could do it, but doing it publicly is like rubbing the nose. But the Muslims, Ian, Muslims of Dallas were very well prepared for this for the last 2 months. They all agreed in forums, wrote with each other, and agreed not to respond or react and just stay away from it. And they did. They did a very good job. From somewhere along, these two stray Muslims, and now that I believe they are identified as Muslims, these two guys come and resort to shooting. I mean, they're as bad as Pamela Geller herself. Both are provocative. Both are disturbing the peace and the costing the security of the city. And that is uncalled for. And it's an undesirable public safety nightmare. So I do not approve that. I was with her just about an hour ago with Sean Hannity on Fox News. And she accuses me that Islam does not permit freedom of speech and that I was deceiving the public. And I have challenged her that sit down with me anytime you want. Show me where you find Islam is against freedom of speech. So that's where we are. And this is a very sad event that happened. And I condemn that. I hope it does not tar the cohesive fabric of Dallas. In Dallas, Muslims, Christians, Jews, we all work together very well for the last 20-some years. And any conflict, we come together in conferences, we come together and pray. But this has really torn us apart. But I hope it doesn't leave a deep scar among us.
So I would ask you, though, since you are a Muslim from India, Mike, why do you bother to debate Pamela Geller? You were just on Fox, on Hannity, you just mentioned that. I'm sure privately she says terrible things about you and all other Muslims. Publicly, I'm sure she keeps saying that, I'm not against Islam, I'm only against radical Islam. That's her mantra, but it doesn't hold water. I mean, the woman's record is pretty clear that she's a bigot. And I'm just wondering, you just seem to be an extremely generous person to dignify her with your politeness.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, Ian. It is not dignifying her. It is when the public hears Hannity or any other show, and whatever she says, people may consume it in wholesale. By being there, opposing her respectfully, I'm causing those people who are on the fence, who are not sure what is right, to let them know that there is another point of view. And I'm appealing to those moderate Americans who really don't want to believe Pamela Geller. But since there is no other option for them, they tend to go along with it. So that is an option that I offer them, that yes, there is another point of view. I don't have any qualms with her. She is definitely a bigot. But I don't have anything against her. I hope someday she can see a point of view. But right now it is not anything she wants to do concretely. It is just random shooting at people and random attacks on Islam. For example, she also attacked on halal, that is the Muslim way of sacrificing the animal. She attacked that severely. Then the Jewish leaders realized that she was attacking actually on the kosher way of sacrificing the animal. So they tried to talk to her out. When she had posters in the subway in New York, I was on Fox News in different times. And I told her that this is a dangerous thing. She's not achieving anything for Israel, but she's creating animosity and resentment. And those bigots who are traveling in the subway, if they see a face that is Eastern, regardless of Hindu, Sikh, Muslim, or anything, they will hurt them. Indeed, one of the Indian Hindus was killed in one of those things. And I mentioned to her that she should be held accountable for that because of the posts that happened. Now again, I mentioned to her that she should be held accountable for the two deaths that occurred in Dallas, in Garland.
Well, but she's being effective in the worst possible way across America, because over 20 states in the United States have passed anti-Sharia laws. The idea that in Kansas and Oklahoma, Sharia law is about to be imposed is the most ridiculous fantasy imaginable. But it's obviously taken hold in the imagination in the paranoid heartland of America. So, you know, I'm not holding you responsible, Mike, but somebody has got to reverse this trend. I mean, the Gellers of this world are able to spread this insane poison and get legislatures to pass these nonsensical laws as though there's this lurking threat of Sharia law, which, you know, the only people in this country that are pushing religious bigotry, as far as I can tell, are the fundamentalist Christians. The Muslims are very much on the defensive, and they continually keep having to apologize all the time. I find it very troubling that the Gellers of this world aren't being sufficiently challenged. I'm not blaming you. I'm just saying we need something stronger, don't you think?
I think so. I appreciate you expressing this thought. I have been thinking about it. In fact, about a year ago, we set up a conference on Sharia where we invited Pamela Geller and David Yerushalmi and two other Muslim scholars to just to point out to the public that the Sharia she is talking about is not, Muslims have no, did not ask Sharia to be brought into America. Yes, there are some individuals who may have said that, but Muslims, organizations, Muslims in general don't want the kind of Sharia that is practiced in Iran and Pakistan and few other countries. Sharia basically is like, if you call it Christian Sharia, if a person, a Christian person dies, there is a process of burial. That is a Sharia. There is a process of prayer when you go to the church. There is a process of bar mitzvah for Jewish kids. So these are the things that are personal nature. And people will continue to practice that. Whereas the Sharia for public consumption, which happens only if there is a Muslim government and also if the majority okays it. In Indonesia, there is no Sharia law. There is Turkey, there is no Sharia law. In Malaysia, there is no Sharia law. They are the democracies. So we need to promote democracies where people see the civil laws serve the justice instead of the Sharia law. It's unfortunate. The Sharia law is abused in certain nations, and it has got some flaws in it. We need to rectify those flaws. And Muslims finally are getting up, waking up, and making those corrections. I am one of those daredevils who has challenged the Sharia and written an article called Dividing Sharia into Public Domain and Private Domain. I have no problems with the private domain. That is between oneself and God, how you pray, how you fast, how you interact. That is fine. But the public Sharia is got some flaws, like blasphemy, apostasy, stoning women to death. Those are the problem areas. We need to fix them as Muslims. And I have challenged Muslims, and many are challenging now. That had never happened in the last 1,400 years. The challenges have occurred in the last 5 years, and people are getting to it. Conferences are being held, and things will change. And I am willing to take up Pamela Geller. I'm looking to move to Washington, D.C., in the next 2 to 3 months and do this as a full-time, as opposed to what I'm doing as a passion. And I want to do this as a full-time and take on Pamela Geller boldly. and because she is wrong from the word go. She doesn't hold water. Somehow she's gotten away. It's time to stop her, not from speaking or doing what she wants to do, but spreading falsities. That's what I want to do.
Well, Mike Gauss, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much, Ian. And I think I must appreciate you for giving Muslims and people like me an opportunity to for the general public to see that there is another way of looking at things. And thank you for that.
Certainly welcome. And again, I've been speaking with Mike Gauss, who's the president of the America Together Foundation and the Foundation for Pluralism, based in Dallas, Texas. He's a speaker, writer, educator, and an activist for pluralism, interfaith, Islam, Israel, India, and human rights. And his work is listed at mikegauss.net. And his daily blog is thegaussdiary.com. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about new evidence and lines of inquiry into the disappearance of 43 students in Mexico. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ryan Devereaux, who is a Brooklyn-based journalist covering national security and criminal justice for The Intercept. His work has appeared at The Guardian, RollingStone.com, The Nation, Democracy Now!, and The Village Voice. And his latest article at The Intercept is Ghosts of Iguala, Mexico, How 43 Students Disappeared in the Night. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ryan Devereaux.
Thank you for having me.
And Ryan, I remember covering the story at the time, and it's so grim and so hideous what happened. But we sort of thought we had the story. And now, from your reporting, it indicates that much of what we think might have been the story, particularly in terms of the convenient villains in the piece, may well not be the whole story. So let's begin with that. What's your sense of the big missing chunks that you have uncovered?
Yeah, I mean, so our investigation is based on dozens of interviews with students who survived the violence that night and parents of the disappeared, journalists in Mexico. And on top of that, we've obtained a lot of documents from the federal government's investigation into what happened, which include dozens of statements from detained municipal police officers and alleged gang members who are said to have taken part in the events that night. And sort of what emerges from those materials is a number of sort of inconvenient facts that challenge the narrative that the government has presented to Mexico. And this is a story that's been developing, you know, for months since the students disappeared in September, and Mexican journalists have really chipped away at a lot of the government's official version of events using federal transparency laws to produce documents. And, you know, day by day, as this story has evolved, we've seen a concerted effort on the part of the federal government to present a story in which these crimes are limited to a small circle of municipal officials. And that's understandable, because limiting it to a small number of municipal officials sort of excuses broader responsibility for the crimes, including potential roles that the military may have played and roles that more senior state level, potentially federal officials might have played, or what they might have known regarding the events that night.
And of course, the so-called imperial couple, the mayor and his wife of this town of Iguala, I think it's the third largest town in the state of Guerrero on mm-hmm. the Pacific coast, where Acapulco is.
Yeah.
At the time, they just seemed so hideous. But the idea that perhaps the military were involved, even to the extent that maybe the students disappeared, the 43 that disappeared might have been cremated in a military crematorium, really is quite extraordinary. And so obviously the parents never believed the government story, and indeed what the press reported at the time. What was your sense from them? Who do they think, and not that you could speak for all 43 parents, but who do they think was behind it?
Well, the parents' suspicion immediately turned to the military right away. And lawyers for the families aren't necessarily accusing the military of directly participating in the events that night. What they're asking for is a thorough investigation of what the Army knew and when. What comes out of the documents, when you read them closely from some of the detainees, is a picture of a military that was at military forces that were at the very least turning a blind eye to the sort of criminal takeover of the region, and at worst, potentially actively complicit in a lot of the disappearances that have plagued the area in recent years. And the mayor and his wife, as you mentioned, were sort of convenient villains, but when you look closely at the government's evidence against them, it's fairly thin. The two of them were held in preventative detention for weeks as the government tried to make its charges against them stick. The actual evidence that Abarca, the mayor, knew what was going to happen to the students or directed what was going to happen to the students that night is based off some really problematic, self-incriminating testimony that doesn't really stand up to scrutiny. And, you know, when you look at what the government has claimed happened to the students, the scientific possibility of these students being cremated in an outdoor open pit in the drizzling rain overnight is dubious, to say the least. Scientists and forensics experts have questioned it thoroughly. And in December, some academics from two of Mexico's most prestigious universities published a report revealing that had the gang members used the sort of resources that they claimed that they used, which was wood and tires and gasoline to burn the students, it would have required 33 tons of wood. It would have taken up a space 10 times the trash pit where the students were allegedly incinerated. They would have needed 115 pounds of gasoline per body. If they would have used tires as a primary source of fuel, it would have required nearly 1,000 tires. That would have left 2.5 tons of steel wire behind. And these materials would have had to have been, of course, collected, you know, on the fly that night. So it's kind of hard to believe that these gangsters managed to pull off such a tremendous feat, incinerating 43 bodies in a pit like the government claims that they have. And so it was in this context that the parents, you know, questioned the initial version of events. I mean, you also have to remember that early on in the case, the government was using the statements of detainees saying that they had found or potentially found the students in other locations. And then when they searched those locations, it turned out that there were bodies there, but none of them belonged to the students. So there's a lot to question here. And there's also, you know, decades of historical context to keep in mind. Guerrero was the front line of Mexico's dirty wars in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. The military disappeared people by the hundreds, dropped prisoners out of airplanes while they were alive, tortured people, you know, committed extrajudicial killings. And to date, no government official, no member of the military has been held accountable for those crimes.
And again, I'm speaking with Ryan Devereaux, who is a Brooklyn-based journalist covering national security and criminal justice for The Intercept. His work has appeared at The Guardian, RollingStone.com, The Nation, Democracy Now!, and The Village Voice. And his latest article at The Intercept is Ghosts of Iguala, Mexico, How 43 Students Disappeared in the Night. And the telling of what actually happens to the students, which is the beginning of your piece, Ryan, is so devastating. Now, of course, we learned at the time that these students had some interesting practices in expropriating buses. They came from a very Marxist teacher's college, and that they had this practice of expropriating buses and negotiating with bus drivers in order to attend demonstrations. So apparently that had put them on the police radar and the military's radar from the get-go, hadn't it?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, even before the commandeering of buses became a sort of staple of what the students do in order to get around the state of Guerrero to you know, attend protests, like you said, and to observe rural school teachers at work, which is, you know, what they're studying to become. the schools were already on the government's radar in during the years of the dirty war. As I mentioned, schools like this played a crucial role. The most famous guerrilla leader in Mexican history, Lucio Cabañas, was a graduate of this very same school, Ayotzinapa, and he was a sort of this central figure leading this fight against the government in the mountains of Guerrero. So there's this very, very long history of the government sort of strangling these schools of economic resources and at times violent confrontations. In 2011, two students from Ayotzinapa were killed during a protest on a highway. They had shut down the highway in order to pressure the government into not cutting off funding for them. Hundreds of members of Mexican security forces were dispatched. Two students were shot dead. And so there is a long history here of the government going after these students in these schools.
But in terms of the actual events, the killing of all these students in the buses, and of course it was so indiscriminate, a busload of a soccer team were killed, and not the whole load, but a lot of kids were killed, and a woman was shot sitting in another vehicle nearby. The idea that in a city that you could have a battle zone going on with unarmed students being shot down by the local police with the imperial couple's blessing, and the imperial couple are, what, four or five blocks away doing a political event to promote the wife who's going to take over from the husband, the mayor. So describe the scene, if you will, and particularly what struck me was the role of the military when these students went, many of whom were wounded, went staggering through the night to find medical help, and the military came and, rather than help them, basically accused them of being troublemakers.
Mm-hmm. Well, according to the students' account, they never intended to end up in Igualo that night. They were on the highway trying to collect buses to attend a protest on October 2nd. Remember, this all happened on September 26th, the night of September 26th. They wanted to attend this protest in Mexico City commemorating the 1968 massacre of civilians by Mexican security forces in Mexico City in the days leading up to the Olympics. It's remembered as one of the darkest days in Mexican history. So they had been working to try to get buses for that event, and some students had managed to flag down one bus, and the driver agreed to work with them, according to the students, but first needed to drop off his passengers in Iguala. And that's how a small number of students ended up in the city. Once they did, the students say that they were locked inside the bus. They panicked. They called their comrades who were out on the highway, who came in two other buses, and then managed to free the students that were locked inside. Two more buses were taken, bringing the total to five. Three buses were heading through the center of the city. Two were heading out on a more direct route to the highway. The three buses heading to the center of the city are bogged down. There was the mayor's wife's event that night. Also, the soccer team that was attacked, their game had just got out a little while earlier, so there were a lot of vehicles in the street. The police intercepted the buses, began shooting. The students initially thought that the police officers were shooting into the air. They threw rocks at the police. They soon realized that the police were actually shooting directly at them. And then over the course of the night, there was the initial confrontation in which most of the students were taken there in the center of Iguala. There was the violence that spilled over onto the highway in which the soccer players were attacked and three people were killed. As the students were sort of regrouping in the city after most of their classmates were taken, a second attack happened, and two students were shot dead in the street during that attack. And the Mexican army later found those bodies hours after they had been laying in the street. The students bled to death. Students who weren't killed were scrambling, running to the homes of residents, seeking shelter, pounding on doors, hiding out. Some of them spent the night hiding in the mountains. A number of the students went to a medical clinic nearby, as you mentioned, a private medical clinic. They pounded on the doors. They asked for help. The women working inside the facility said that they couldn't help them. They were scared. The students begged them to call an ambulance instead of a paramedics. Patrols from the 27th Infantry Battalion arrived at the clinic. This is confirmed not only by students, but by Mexican Army records that were released under federal transparency law to a handful of journalists recently. And according to the military's account, they were very helpful with the students, and the students very much appreciated their presence. But if you ask the students that were there, which I did, what their recollection of the event was, it was that the police or the army was extremely threatening They had the students remove their shirts. They rifled through their pockets. They threatened them. They harassed them. They told them that if they didn't give them their real names, that they would never be found. And they were forced back into the street that night without having received any medical care. And so this is the sort of context in which things were playing out that night. And the Army later said that they were the last to learn what happened. The records that we reviewed indicate that that was not the case. And the Army was on the street the entire night patrolling, and they had it seems fairly clear that they had a pretty good sense of what was going on. It's a very dark and a sort of grim sequence of events that played out in the night.
So we have the military who weren't necessarily in complicity, but they certainly had a lot of knowledge. They didn't protect these students from being murdered by the police. And then the other nexus in the original story was, of course, the nexus between the local police and the gangs, the drug gangs, which the imperial couple, the wife of the mayor, her relatives were high up in this gang. And she was reported to have been actually the gang ringleader. And you mentioned that they've been in detention. They're still in detention, the mayor and his wife, aren't they? Charges haven't been filed against them yet.
They are. It's really complicated, the charges against the mayor and his wife. Just about a week and a half ago, charges were lifted against the mayor's wife. The government had twice tried to pin organized crime charges on her, charges related to the student's disappearance. They were unable to make those charges stick. On a third attempt, when the mayor's wife was unable to present a defense for herself, they did manage to get an unrelated money laundering charge to stick. And she was being held on that. Then those charges were lifted. Judge determined that her due process rights had been violated and the government lacked evidence. New charges were reinstated just days ago. The mayor, meanwhile, his charges have remained murky throughout all of this. Initially, he was held on charges that had nothing to do with the student's disappearance, but another kidnapping in Iguala that he had been linked to and a murder that he had been linked to. But the sort of overlap that you described between the municipal police and elements of organized crime in Iguala and Kokula come out quite clearly in the documents that we reviewed, the statements of detained gangsters and municipal police who were swept up in the following this investigation. What appears to have happened, and this has happened in a number of areas around Guerrero, is the line between organized crime and security forces largely disappeared. There's the account of the former, sort of chief of the Kokula Police Department, which was the neighboring police department that helped the municipal police in Iguala detain the students that night. He describes how his department was taken over by a man, his subcomandante, who was a Mexican Army veteran, and how this man threatened him and, threatened to kill him, kill his family if he didn't sort of allow him to run the police department as he saw fit. This police chief in Kokula complained to the Army, allegedly in 2013, that his department had been taken over by a criminally linked individual and his sort of cohort of fellow police officers. And according to his account, the Mexican Army did nothing. And these individuals went on to become, according to the government's account, key perpetrators in the events that night. And these are police officers who went to great lengths to try to cover up what they did, destroying documents, destroying video surveillance evidence, issuing threats among police officers that if you saw anything, if you talk about what you saw, you're going to be killed. It's a very corrupt doesn't really begin to describe the sort of situation that we're talking about here.
So, but do you think the military are complicit, or are they just have that sort of contemptuous attitude towards these rebellious students, and that they basically have the attitude, well, you kids brought it on yourselves? I'm trying to get that sort of line there, because while one is very suspicious of the government's inquiry, and the Mexican people apparently are very unhappy. And we all recall, I think it was it the Attorney General at the press conference who sort of tried to close the book on it all, and at the end he's caught on mic sort of saying, I need to rest now or something, which infuriated the entire populace of Mexico.
Yeah, I mean, the soldiers definitely articulated that sort of you were getting what's coming to you message to the students. I mean, I spoke to one student who was there at the medical clinic who says that's exactly what they told him. The line of investigation regarding the Army needs to be pursued. We don't know all of the details about what the Army knew and when they knew it, but the evidence that does exist that we have seen indicates that there are good reasons to continue this line of investigation. And the Mexican government so far, the federal government, has denied that there's any value in pursuing that line of investigation, and that should really be questioned here.
So what's the next step then? I mean, the parents still don't buy anything that's been told to them. The press is still chipping away at this, as you've mentioned. And I'm sure Peña Nieto wants to close the book, even though it's the rival leftist party that's gotten a black eye since these crooked local politicians in league with their own criminal police organizations in league with organized crime belong to the PRD, right?
Right, that's correct. Well, the investigation's in a very interesting sort of phase right now. Under Mexican law, under transparency laws in Mexico, both certain state laws and a specific federal law, crimes that indicate human rights abuses, sort of grave human rights abuses, have a special category. When that sort of evidence emerges, the government has an obligation to produce files on its own investigation, public files, publicly available files. And last year, in October, the state of Guerrero produced a public file detailing elements of its investigation for those very reasons. The federal government was later ordered by an independent Mexican transparency board, which is actually been responsible for a lot of the government-related document disclosures in this case, ordered the federal government to do the same thing. The claim was that there is evidence here of human rights abuses. The federal government needs to make publicly available documents regarding its investigation. The federal government initially fought that order, arguing that this case represented a case of kidnapping and organized crime, and as such, it had the right to keep its files secret for 12 years. In recent weeks, the federal government seems to be shifting its tone. Murillo Caram, who is attorney general throughout all of this, stepped down. And we've confirmed that the Mexican government is preparing publicly available documents regarding the federal investigation. How long it'll take for those documents to come to light is unclear. There are reportedly 80,000 files in the federal government's office related to this case. But there are efforts to bring more light and more transparency to this case. Meanwhile, a team of independent investigators appointed by the Inter-American Commission Human Rights Organization is looking at the case as well. And they're interviewing detainees who've been arrested. They have traveled to Iguala. They've made two trips. They're in the process, I believe, now in their third trip to Mexico, their fact-finding trips. They are scheduled to speak with members of the 27th Infantry Battalion and question them about their role in the events that night. And they're offering new lines of investigation for the federal government to pursue. And if the federal government does choose to comply and take those recommendations seriously, we may see this case taking a different turn from the tens of thousands of others of similar cases that have occurred in Mexico, you know, over the last nearly decade since the so-called drug war began in 2006.
Well, Ryan Devereaux, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Ryan Devereaux, who's a Brooklyn-based journalist covering national security and criminal justice for The Intercept. His work has appeared at The Guardian, RollingStone.com, The Nation, Democracy Now!, and The Village Voice. And his latest article at The Intercept is Ghosts of Iguala, Mexico, How 43 Students Disappeared in the Night. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.